IVM.
Hi, everybody. Just wanted to ask everyone for a quick favor. We're running a brand survey right now and would really appreciate it if you could let us know what you think about the advertising on IVM. Go to ivmpodcast.com/survey and do let us know. As part of this, we'll be selecting 10 random participants and sending them some IVM swag. So do fill out those surveys.
Hi, and welcome to Know Your Kanoon. This is Amber from Vietnam Ventures. Welcome to another edition of Know Your Kanoon. And this time I have someone very special with me. He's the founder of TMT Law Practice. For those of you who do not know TMT Law, it is a boutique IP law firm with having 7 offices across India. It is one of the pioneer in the niche firms in technology media space. I have Mr. Malhotra with me. And sir, thank you so much for sparing time and coming on the show. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. Just to give a brief intro about him, I think sir has over 2 decades of experience in the space of IP and law. He is considered one of the main founders of the evolution in IP in the legal industry, I would say. He's also a member of the State Bar of California and Delhi. Sir, rest, I'll leave it up to you to do the honors because you have so much on you that I think it would take, I would not be able to justify the same. So over to you.
Thank you so much, Amber, for having me here. And it's a pleasure being here and speaking with you and sharing some thoughts today. It's, you know, I usually try to be as modest as I can because you've read out some bits of my,
yes,
whatever I have done in the past. But the only one thing that I would like to add is that while I did start out my career focusing on intellectual property rights, however, over the course of the last 22 odd years, I've had the good fortune and the opportunity to diversify, moving from IP to, you know, because I had done a lot of work in IP-related media stuff. So then I moved into the non-IP aspects of media and advising on that. The regulatory aspects that came in thereafter, as there is an interface between media and telecoms in terms of the regulatory zone that we operate in, which is basically to do with your MIB, TRAI, etc. And then, of course, the Competition Commission of India also came in. That's the reason why I got an opportunity to also delve into some issues of the telecom sector. And then, by the by, expanded it. IP has a great interface with information technology and technology per se. So then got the opportunities to get into more, you know, regular aspects of tech, the policy, the regulatory sphere, fintech, health tech, various aspects of that. So today, perhaps we can say proudly that when it comes to the TMT sector, which is technology, media, and telecommunications, we perhaps are the only firm that stands true to that acronym and is actually doing work in all three sectors. So happy to be here and happy to be able to share some thoughts.
Sir, thank you so much for that, and absolute pleasure again to have you. Let's dissect today's episode, sir, and I'll hand it over to you in terms of you know, talking about the telemedicine, you know, which is a new sector altogether into IP, at least for India, and from a media communication also. I am completely new to this sphere because, you know, I would like to tell all my listeners that, you know, this is such these are such areas that require technical and you know, such kind of knowledge and info that not anyone and everyone can understand that. Of course, there are guidelines, etc., to read about, but we'll hand it over to sir now. Can you explain what telemedicine is all about? Now let's dive, because, you know, people on the show, they don't understand the legal jargon, so I'm not getting into the legal side of things, but just to dissect it from a legal perspective, that, you know, to give the people the hindsight of what this is all about.
Okay, so just getting into some of the more fundamental and basic stuff.
Right.
Telemedicine or telehealth, which is a more broader term to be used,
right,
is essentially the delivery of medical and healthcare services using the telecommunication networks. Right. We are, as a populace, as, you know, possible patients, as caregivers, it's not a concept that is alien to us. It is just being put in a different context these days. Just to give you an example, I think all of us, and I am now, you know, in the wrong side of the 40s, but even at the time that perhaps our parents were consulting doctors, right, it would be very commonplace to pick up the phone and speak with a doctor, not having the requirement to go and actually visit the doctor in the clinic or the hospital, unless absolutely necessary. So very often we would just call them up, tell them this is the problem that we are facing, and they would deliver some sort of a medication or otherwise. And they would always say that, look, if this doesn't work for the next 2-3 days, please give me a call or come and see me.
Right.
That, very frankly, that's the origin of telemedicine, which is delivery of your medical or healthcare solution using the telecommunication network of just the telephone. Over a period of time, with the development of technology, we, and of course the push with the courts that there should be healthcare is, you know, now considered a fundamental right. Quality healthcare is the next aspect that we are trying to address. We all know that now in every field of the profession, whether it is legal, you know, chartered accountancy, architecture, and of course, medicine, right, people, and all of us are in that sort of rat race to be associated with the best hospitals, to be earning a fair amount of money for our services. So everyone is therefore, at least at the professional level, trying to chase or be in a bigger city so that they will not only get access to better opportunities, but also be able to make a place for themselves. What does telemedicine do for us? It allows not only the doctors to continue to be in their respective hometowns while they are delivering quality healthcare to pretty much any part in the world, but it also enables patients who may not have the means to travel all the way to a bigger city or sometimes even overseas to be able to get quality legal advice sitting in their, either in their own homes or in, you know, in cases where you're talking about at the government level, in the primary healthcare centers that are available. So what telemedicine basically does is, conceptually, the guidelines that have been issued last year have only made the practice of telemedicine or telehealth a little easier and a little more streamlined. It's certainly that those guidelines that have been notified are always subject to change, amendment, improvement from time to time, just to address the development of technology, the needs of the people, etc. But right, at the heart of it is the possibility of being able to provide quality healthcare services at your doorstep. And now if we are getting everything delivered at our doorstep, why should healthcare be left behind is the concept behind telemedicine.
No, absolutely, sir. And, you know, very nicely put by you. In fact, I want to bring it to the listeners that what sir is talking about is that, you know, given the size of India and given the ratio of doctors to the amount of population we have, most of the people do not get the due medical care they would want, being in remote areas or in such areas where it's not accessible. Also, the gender gap in the country is another reason. And having this telemedicine, the advent of telemedicine, it is quite easy for now you to access and consult. So I had a point here. Now, you said, you know, the guidelines have been recently framed, etc. But I mean, and this is why I want your expert comment on this, that I believe about 2-3 years back, until about 2017 or 18, the field of psychiatry, I believe, and psychologists were remotely operating in malls, right? There was a phase where they were providing consultancy, you know, remotely from these areas where people could just walk into these booths in the mall, log in and pay the respective fee. And you had a psychologist who would just counsel you on your mental health issues. So it's not something that India has not been, I mean, of course, medicine being a different area, but in lines with, I would say, healthcare and medicine, this has always been around. And as you said, it's been on the phone. But was it even legal to do such an activity back then when the frame line and the guidelines were not there? Was it something legal? I mean, I would want your comments on that. That was that allowed?
No, but that's a fantastic question. In fact, let me tell you that I am very closely associated in an advisory capacity with the Telemedicine Society of India.
Right, sir.
And as I had just mentioned and you sort of reiterated, sir, the guidelines for these have only been released in March of last year. Right. Of course, it was accelerated because of the COVID pandemic and therefore right, people not being able to go out of their houses to for medical attention. But it only came in last year. So right, every year that I used to go for their annual convention,
right,
people would turn up and ask me the same question and again, that you are telling us that we can do X, Y, and Z. But look, A, is this even legal? And B, I have heard of horror stories where a particular, you know, teleconsult or a consultation or the effect of that has gone wrong. And instead of quote unquote blaming the issue itself, people, the patients are going to the cops and filing complaints against the doctors who have tried to treat them, saying that they're doing something illegal. Unfortunately, there was also a judgment of a court which seemed to suggest that practice of telemedicine was in itself illegal. But my answer to your question is that the guidelines, and they say so very clearly, they right, only make the practice of telehealth or telemedicine a more streamlined process. That is, if there was something illegal, we right, would have had to have a law, new law in place to categorically say that the telemedicine is legal. But that's not the case.
That's
not it, has always been legal.
Right.
The only thing is, what are the circumstances or the conditions in which you can administer advice on the phone or on a virtual platform? And what are the circumstances where you must ask the patient to come and see you physically? What is important to note is telemedicine is not a substitute for inpatient evaluation, in-person evaluation, right? So, and the guidelines themselves say very clearly, you obviously cannot do surgery through telemedicine. At this juncture, we do not have the technology or even the wherewithal to be able to sustain that. You can administer immediate first aid. You can prescribe a certain list of identified medications only. So it's a practice that is regulated, but certainly not prohibited and therefore definitely legal.
Absolutely, sir. So, you know, that raises a couple of interesting points, you know, for discussion, which is accountability, as you said, that, you know, if someone's rendered an advice, right, and I would say, let's say a video conferencing has happened between two set of individuals, one being a doctor, one being the patient or the client. Now, in that situation, sir, how do these new set of guidelines that we're talking about, how do they hold the individual accountable? Let's say, you know, sometimes it's a mistake while delivering a professional service, which cannot be undone. And it happens to an extent. And when you're doing it virtually, it increases the liability as well. And I'm sure absolute and strict liability here would be something that would come into picture, that negligence cannot be afforded. Now, in that context, I would want you to explain, you know, to our listeners, what are the current guidelines where we would say that, how are the people bound? Because, you know, sir, I believe if the advice is rendered in written, then it would have more effect, right? I mean, I can fax it to you or I can send it to you by email. It's a written advice. But when it's done virtually, let's say if someone is just going through a monologue with the patient and giving advice just while talking, I mean, what would be the differentiation? How is the accountability work in this space? And what is the modus operandi, if you could just throw some light on that?
Sure. So like I said, in an answer to your earlier question, that this has never been illegal.
Right.
Similarly, the same aspect also applies to this part of your question, which is to say that the duty of care that a doctor stroke medical practitioner owes to his or her patients continues to be at the same level, whether you are consulting in person or you are consulting in an online environment, right? Right. So, your duty to care does not increase mm-hmm. or decrease only because you are consulting virtually. What you need to, however, figure out is, and you rightly brought up some of those issues right now. Let's assume I'm a doctor sitting in Delhi.
Right.
You're a doctor in Lucknow.
Right.
And you have a patient sitting with you. Now, you may have an inkling about what that patient is suffering from, but you wish to take an expert opinion from me, and we schedule that call to do so. What your requirement and my requirement simultaneously is that we need to at least follow certain basic guidelines to ensure that the communication infrastructure that we are using is robust enough. Because tomorrow, it should not be that between you and I, we have a disconnect as to what I told you and what you heard.
Right.
Because in person, it's not so difficult. You're communicating, you can seek a clarification, whatever it is. On the network, there are time lags. There are, you know, there could be distortions in whatever has been heard or what has not been understood properly. So A, no one is saying that you need to have state-of-the-art architecture in your networks, but you need to have at least that basic minimum that is standard. What is standard is yet not specified, by the way. The second is that the duty of care with regard to the patient, certainly as between you and me in the example that I gave you,
right?
We are both professionals. There will be that level of judgment that we need to both exercise.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, the patient is sitting with you. You are able to observe the physical attributes possibly better than I can. I'm sure over a period of time, technology will develop to a certain extent that the resolution on a camera will possibly be better than what the eye can see. But we may not have reached that level yet.
Right.
So in that situation, you will be in a better position to assess not only what the patient is exhibiting in terms of symptoms, but also you will be able to exercise a judgment that the specialist giving advice on a particular aspect is or is not right. The patient would have heard the specialist, possibly. You would have heard the specialist, and we are assuming that the communication line is absolutely fine. There's no problem on that. I've communicated what I think should be done to you. The patient has heard it. Yet, it is your duty to a slightly higher extent to be able to either accept my advice as an expert advice or go with your own advice and tell the patient that this is what should be done. So your duty of care in those circumstances is slightly higher. But it remains the same in terms of a test that it does not increase only because there is a telemedicine consultation going on.
Right, sir. No, very rightly put by you. In fact, when one thinks of it, like when we talk on the show about technology and stuff, it's very rightly put by you that, you know, all these parameters need to be in place. But sir, the major challenge that I also feel could come into the, and I'll point them out, which I feel, and maybe you can explain, isn't there a chance of data loss and data being compromised? Number one, because you know how the data sphere currently is, I mean, with the hackers and with so many apps and technologies being misused for different purposes, there is a major scare that anybody would have. And, you know, passing off on this data as well, like the historical background, you keep shifting it between medical practitioners, the more vulnerable you are. I mean, there are a set of apps that have been prescribed. But, I mean, how is that being regulated? And how can one be sure that, you know, there won't be, that their data is safe, their in confidential information is safe?
Sure. So let's look at, I'm doing this comparison, which I like to do from the brick and mortar world to the digital space.
Right.
When I go to visit a doctor, I expect that the doctor will maintain the confidentiality of our discussion.
Right.
That the notes that the doctor is taking will be kept confidential, that they will not be made available to all and sundry, and that there will be nevertheless a record created, which I can ask to access if the need so arises.
Okay.
In the digital and the telemedicine sphere, the same obligations of confidentiality and data protection continue to subsist. Mm-hmm. The only additional layer that gets added is that because we are dealing with data in the digital sphere and it is stored at a location which is not just a paper or a file that is being kept. That needs to be the place where it is being stored or the platform that is storing it needs to follow the requirements of the Information Technology Act with regard to data protection. Once we have the Personal Data Protection Bill becoming law, then that obligation will, of course, take over. But currently, it's not as if there is a lack of any set of obligations that govern the data protection. And the doctors or the medical practitioners have to abide by all those relevant provisions in order to maintain the sanctity of data. We are looking actually at a situation where, and for telemedicine to be working to its full capacity, we need to have a national health database.
Right.
With a similar type of platforms across the country, which can interact and talk with each other so that A, there is seamless movement and availability of data across platforms. And at the same time, they need to be robust enough from a protection and data protection standpoint to be able to retain and maintain the confidentiality. And just giving you an example of how that is helpful. I grew up, my father was in a transferable job. I moved from Kanpur to Lucknow, to back to Kanpur, to Nainital, to Delhi, and then went to study in Bangalore, then went overseas. So at any given point in time, I may have had different types of issues from a medical standpoint.
Right.
Now, if I'm going to meet a doctor today and there is a medical issue which the doctor feels could have a history to it, I am not supposed to be able to remember each and every instance of what I have gone through. But with a click of a button, the doctor may be able to pull up my records, of course, with my consent, because that will help the doctor analyze my current issue better and prescribe the correct treatment. So that's the advantage of getting there. We've yet not got there, but that's the advantage that telemedicine opens up, at the same time retaining the obligations of maintaining confidentiality and privacy.
Right, sir. No, so that also raises another important point. While you were we've been discussing this, it is about consent. You know, legally speaking, the right to consent of the patient to be examined, etc. Now, don't you think that could be a troublesome area when we're on technology? And in certain areas, technology is not as smooth as I would say it would be in metros. So, I mean, how can one address and be sure that, you know, that, because that's a gray area, you would agree that consent is an area where you need to be certain, right? And on that context, I wanted to also club in another thing, which was, you know, maintaining the digital trail, which helps you deal with consent and you know, also in terms of one would want to keep themselves safe. I mean, what can you highlight about the area of consent, which would play a major part in the evolution of this?
So, look, one of the aspects that is, in fact, specifically embedded in the regulations, the guidelines that we are talking about,
right,
is the aspect of consent.
Right.
Right. So, and you look at different scenarios to either specifically record the consent or to infer the consent. Typically speaking, if the patient is initiating the telemedicine consultation, then the patient is asking for such a consultation to be administered. And in that event, consent is implied.
Okay.
Right? If, however, the telemedicine consultation is being originated either by a registered medical practitioner or, let's say, a caregiver, I am not in a position to give consent. I'm in such a bad situation that I possibly can't be expected to give a consent. There will be my caregiver, my wife, my parents, my family, my friends. They will give that consent. So in that situation, if they're originating it, I may be asked to give a consent, maybe retrospectively, but that may be specifically recorded. And the guidelines categorically mandate that the explicit consent of the patient has to be recorded. It can be recorded in any form. It can be done by an email, it can be done by a text message or an audio or video message. And you can possibly devise a particular line that you can ask the patient to repeat. So that from a doctor's registered medical practitioner's perspective, you know, from a future standpoint, if he can be, he or she is questioned whether or not you got the consent, they must put that down in their record to say that this is how I obtained the consent and this is the evidence of that. So consent, as you have correctly identified, is an extremely important aspect and has categorically been dealt with in these guidelines.
Absolutely, sir. That would bring some relief. But I also wanted to highlight another point, which was that I mean, and this is something that I had read before the session, you know, and I've been reading on it. It was that the purpose of telemedicine, which started in the 1960s and probably around that time in the US, or I would say Soviet Union or erstwhile Russia, was basically with regards to the needs of NASA with respect to their programs, space programs, and they needed remote guidelines and assistance with respect whatever and military installations. Now we see this in this era where it is just a tap away and anyone and everyone can use. But in those situations, there is a catch. The catch which I feel would be that sometimes the doctor is not available and you have to rush to an assistant, or the doctor might say that a nurse or another health worker of any grade who's readily available to administer that particular guidance, or I would say that aid. How would that operate? Because, you know, a registered medical practitioner, of course, being a doctor or a certified professional, but even healthcare workers fall somewhat in the subcategory. How does that operate? How would it operate? Because then the accountability, again, will come into picture, because there would be a blockchain between the registered medical practitioner, the healthcare, the health worker, and of course, the client being, or the patient being on the other side. How would this operate? Can a health worker do the same in the shoes of a medical practitioner when it comes to this?
No, so very clearly, like the obligation exists on a registered medical practitioner in the brick and mortar world, likewise, right, there is only a limitation that to a certain extent a health worker can do whatever they can do. And because of the fact that these telemedicine practice guidelines have, you know, the reason why they are applicable, the reason why they have sanctity is because they have been included by this, notification into the Indian Medical Council Professional Conduct Ethics and Etiquette Regulations. So it's part of the, the conduct regulations that are governing registered medical practitioners. It's only a registered medical practitioner that can administer that. The health worker can only participate in the process of originating the teleconsult. So let's assume that you have a primary healthcare clinic in a small town or even a village.
Right.
It may not be possible for that PHC to be managed or manned or whatever by a doctor of certain qualification at every possible PHC level. In that event, they may have a health worker there. The health worker certainly does not have the right to administer medical opinion or advice, but they can facilitate the process of consultation. Likewise, a patient approaches the PHC, says, I need a consultation. This is what my problem is. The health worker will say, okay, fine. I will introduce you via the telemedicine platform to a regular doctor in the local nearest hospital or whatever that is connected to it.
Right.
And there, once I do, then the health worker does that. They will take that explicit consent of the patient that they are ready to be participating in this process. So that's the limited extent to which the health worker will exercise their, role in the entire process.
All right, sir. Lastly, sir, before we close, another important aspect which I feel, could be helpful to the audience or to the listeners would be about restrictions in this area, because prescription of medication, whether it is over the counter or whether tele means, is one dicey area where, which medicines are safe to prescribe, which are not. And in that aspect, I would like to highlight that, there are certain malpractices that are followed by doctors for, and across the world, it's just not India, for whatever reasons it is. And in that aspect, are there some specific restrictions on what kind or grade of drugs can be prescribed? This I'm asking from a perspective that where, you know, tomorrow when accountability comes into picture, and that would be our closing note, that, you know, what is the legal recourse in case a consultation goes south? Is there a specific restriction on the grade of drugs or on how they have to be prescribed or what is allowed to be prescribed and what is not?
So there is a particular section of these guidelines that deals only with the prescription of medicine.
All right.
And that's deliberately said because very often, you know, the whole purpose of carrying out a consultation is A, to determine what the ailment is, and then, of course, to consequently give the right medication for that.
Right.
So if that's the importance that is accorded to it, and that's why the 3.7.4 is the regulation that deals with prescribing medicines. And it goes into very specific aspects of the fact that the RMP, the registered medical practitioner, certainly has the discretion to prescribe medication, A. B, the level of accountability is the same as in the case of an in-person consultation.
Understood.
C, if that person or the RMP feels that even though they have gathered some amount of data and input based upon that telemedicine consultation, they would need to carry out a further more detailed analysis, which can only be done in an in-person consult, they should not prescribe the medication unless they have met the patient in person and finalize their diagnosis. However, if they are able to finalize their diagnosis with that level of accountability that is available or affixable in an in-person consultation, they definitely can prescribe medication. It very clearly says prescribing medicines without an appropriate diagnosis or provisional diagnosis will amount to a professional misconduct. But if you have come up with an appropriate diagnosis and you are in a position where you think that it is appropriate to prescribe drugs, you can by all means do that. So that's an aspect of the professional judgment. Then, because of the fact that this process is new, and some people will take some time to get used to it, both from a patient as well as a doctor's point of view. Therefore, realizing that, the government has restricted, made a list of certain medications which can and all others cannot be prescribed. And it's called, it's grouped or categorized as O, A, B, and those that are prohibited. So list group O is where you can consult, you can only prescribe those medications when the mode of consultation is anything. It could be text, video, audio, anything. You can prescribe these medications regardless of what the nature of consultation is. Is it a first consultation? Is it a follow-up consultation? And there's a list is set out in, typically these are, you know, the OTC medications such as paracetamol, etc. Then the second list of group is list A, which requires mandatorily that there should have been at least a video consultation. And the nature of consultation should definitely be a first consultation. Right. Or if it is a follow-up, then it should be for continuation of medications. And there's a separate list for that. Then there is B. Then there are those categories that are specifically prohibited, which are not to be prescribed. And these are, of course, the Schedule X drugs, etc.
All right. So for all the listeners, you can go through the guidelines. As sir has mentioned, there are annexures, there are sections which are mentioned for you to read. And of course, you can listen to us for the ease of understanding what we just covered. So lastly, and the very last point before we conclude, what is the redressal mechanism in case something goes wrong on a telemedicine platform? What would you have to say on that? What is the redressal mechanism where people, is it the same in case of medical negligence? Do we follow the same guidelines? Or is there something different here in terms of the redressal mechanism, you know, for telemedicine practice area?
So the short answer is that the mechanism remains the same.
All right.
And it remains the same till such time that there is any change or a specialized mechanism that is set up for that.
Right.
The other important thing to be remembered is that while, of course, this is a new thing and there is every effort, because it does require some amount of training to be imparted to the doctors
right.
to be conversant with this. And that's an ongoing process. In fact, immediately after these guidelines were notified in March, along with the Telemedicine Society of India, you know, myself and a couple of my other colleagues went on these daily briefing sessions where we were trying to train them from a regulatory standpoint. But now it's been required, mandated that within 3 years from the notification, so basically before the middle of 2023, people have to voluntarily do these trainings. But after 2023, in each of the courses that the MBBS doctors, sort of the doctors undertake as part of the MBBS course, there will be a specific course also on telemedicine. So the answer remains unchanged. It is the same process, but there will be that level of imparting of training so that every doctor that you will possibly interact with post 2023 or maybe 2-3 years thereafter will be conversant with how to administer, what are the issues, what are the safeguards to be taken into consideration.
All right, sir. So with that, we'll have to end this session today. It was such a pleasure chatting with you and going through this new concept that at least I was unaware of. And thank you so much for taking our time and thank you for being with us. And we'd love to have you more on the show. And I hope you had a great experience chatting with us. And hopefully this will do a lot of wonders for our audience because they are always in awe of new law being decodified and being simplified for them. Thank you so much, sir. Thanks a lot. We had a pleasure having you here.
Thanks so much, Amber. And thank you so much for inviting me to this. And always a pleasure to share whatever I can.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, everybody. It's been a great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On The Wire Talks, Siddharth is joined by Nikhil Anand, an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania and an environmental anthropologist. They discuss his plan and proposal to the BMC to fight the effects of climate change that we are already seeing in Mumbai. In the podcast special on Storytellers and Storytellers, Vineet talks to the host of New Kids on the Block, Anya Kavya Anthare, about what it's like to be Indian teenage podcasters. In the season 3 finale of Echoes of India, Anirudh explores South Asia at the time of its most famous ancient figure, Ashoka Maurya. On All Things Policy, Suyash and Aditya analyze the constant changes of China's generals in their liberation army and what it means for India. And on Smarter with Sid, learn from Siddharth how listening can help you make a better presentation. Do follow us on social media. We're IVM Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And remember, if you're enjoying this show or any of our other shows for that matter, please do tell a friend. It really does help us. And finally, we'd like to thank our sponsors on the network this week, Cred, Bank of Baroda, Quarter, CoinSwitch, Kuber, and Inter VPro. Thank you so much for making this possible.
Have you ever wondered where the business world is headed? How the ways in which we create, market, and sell to consumers will evolve? Or if we'll ever go back to wearing pants while working? For answers to all of this and more, tune into Advertising is Dead with me, Varun Dugirala. Every Tuesday, as I talk to entrepreneurs, leaders, and change makers from across business, media, marketing, and beyond. You can catch all episodes of Advertising is Dead on the IBM Podcast website, app, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Do you wonder why China does the things that it does? Or want to know how we could improve online privacy? Or perhaps you're thinking about how we can kickstart India's economy? If you'd like to search for the answers to such questions, check out All Things Policy, a daily public policy podcast that covers everything from employment figures to aircraft carriers. Tune in from Monday to Friday for new episodes and fresh takes.